Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben van der Velde, and this week you find us at the back of the lecture hall listening to Professor Rylan Crox, Norfolk's number one Brian Cox impersonator. So far, we're into the fourth hour of his piece entitled Quantum Schmontum. Who needs uncertainty anyway? Not me, or do I? Maybe. I've no idea. Do you? Who knows? Anyway, let's get on with it. He said the phrases amazeballs, squillions and squillions, and that's my superposition, what's yours, whilst making lewd hand gestures so many times. Guys, how have we ended up in this of all possible worlds? I'll tell you who can't tell us, Professor Crox. Luckily, I know someone who might just be able to. He's right here with me, and is the fingernails down the blackboard to my eyebrows blown off by too much magnesium tea. It's Professor Barry McStay.
Oh, I've just realised I'm living in the darkest timeline in my multiverse.
Yeah.
I could be literally anywhere else. I could be hosting the Infinite Monkey Cage with Brian Cox, and here I am with my infinite typewriter typing monkey in the shape of Ben Vanderbilt.
Nice to see you. I've realised I should have called you the emeritus to my professor.
Yeah. But there's very little merit about me, I think.
What is that, you're the one who's more of a Latin scholar than me. What does emeritus mean
context? I think it's usually they keep the title but they don't have to do any work whatsoever, basically. it's like an honorary president of a company, things like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's professor. Professor's a job title.
Yeah.
And so when you retire and you no longer have the job, but you still want the title, you get given that.
It's like American presidents who keep being called Mr. President even when they stop being president. We can't call you professor because you retired from being a professor, so we'll give you another title which has the word professor in it.
Yeah.
It's like the bit in it that when anyone goes, oh my God, when someone called a doctor and someone stands up and goes, I'm a doctor, yes, but not of language and literature. Okay, I'll sit down again.
When we eventually wind up this podcast, I'm definitely going to call myself Emeritus Podcast Host.
Oh, mate, I mean, at the moment, I am very much an emeritus comedian and you're an emeritus actor.
Well, thankfully, our guest this week is not emeritus anything. Our guest this week is a self-proclaimed inventor with a sense of fun, transforming simple electronics into cool gadgets, science into plain English, and problems into opportunities. With any luck, she might turn this hour-long mishmash of nonsense into a comprehensible podcast. She's a fellow of the Institution
of... Not that
of
good.
Thanks for the vote of confidence. She's a fellow of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers and was a judge on BBC's Robot Wars. So which is the greater honour? It's really too close to call. She comes from a family of makers, people who did spinning to woodwork, metalwork to embroidery, but sadly, not peacemakers. Not enough of those in the crafts industry these days. She founded the Guild of Makers, a place for practical people who take pride in creating physical items using their imagination and skills. And to that end, herself has a qualification in wood turning. Presumably that's the thing you do when you pull a pair of chopsticks apart and then run them round and round in your hands for no apparent reason. She also has a PhD in bubbles for the classiest end of day bath you could ever wish for. She improvises, performs stand-up, hosts podcasts, and has written two books, It's Only Rocket Science and Robot, Meet the Machines of the Future, which sound, in that order, like what she shouted back when her suspicious housemate asked her what she was up to in the spare room, and what she said as she finally unveiled her secret project to that now sadly missing housemate, eyes wide with a maniacal gleam. Please welcome the sanest mad scientist we could find, Dr. Lucy Rogers.
Hello!
How are you? and your dog, we have to make clear.
Yes, the snoring and the grunting is not me, it is the dog. I'm fine, thank you.
It's usually our listeners doing the snoring, to be honest.
You can't usually hear them.
To be fair, how are you in lockdown? We're all facing the problem of we've all taken up baking and now there is no flour left in the house. As a maker, what are the vital components to your day-to-day making that you need?
Well, fortunately, I'm a bit of a hoarder as well. And so I had so many projects on the go, half finished, that it's going to take another millennium before I actually get through all my stuff.
Well, this is the time when you find out whether those jobs that really need a doing, if they really need a doing,
I baked focaccia for the first time in my life. During that. I know, right? What? And I have to say, it was amazing.
don't say things like that whilst being 8 miles from me. People, I've been running a weekly pub quiz, and the people who won it, and one of the prizes you can win is that you get to win a bottle of booze chosen from random from my booze suitcase. And the people who won it this week live 20 minutes down the road, so I went to drop it off, and she baked a tiny challah for me.
Amazing.
We had sort of like, you know, those exchanges in Cold War movies that are done underneath car park strip lights at midnight. Well, ours was like the Metropolitan Elite version of that. I left a quarter full bottle of Pernod on her doorstep, and she then handed over a freshly baked challah covered in crushed walnuts.
The eagle flies over Warsaw tonight.
Yeah. Funnily enough, she was Polish.
No way.
I do want to ask Lucy before we start the show. Lucy asked, "Where would you like us to record, in her home studio or in her lab?" Because by that I don't mean the dog, because Labradors are very good at noise cancelling.
you want us in Bernard? They're much more sort of bass and tones.
But you've got a home laboratory. What does that look like?
I like to make things. I make things a lot. So I have a clean room for my electronics. Got oscilloscopes, soldering iron, all the wires and things that one needs to do electronic projects. And in there, I also do all my paperwork. It's the office. But I've also got my workshop in the garage, which has got my wood turning lathe and a metal turning lathe and some other bigger bits of machinery.
I have been watching all of Wallace and Gromit as a soothing balm to all that's been going on in the world, and that is what I imagine your house to be like.
Very much. The dog's eyebrows, definitely.
Please, please tell us you eat breakfast via Rube Goldberg machines.
Yeah, always.
We always like to ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. Now, you're highly accomplished. I imagine you had to dig deep to answer this question. What are you worst at?
Listening to music. Music doesn't do anything for me, and I do most of my work in silence, or I listen to podcasts or the radio, voice radio. I can still have earworms, so the tunes stick. I even belong to a choir for a while, so I can do the tunes, but I just don't like it. It distracts me. It doesn't move me.
Sorry, Ben's shoulders are gone up to his ears, because Ben is, during lockdown, has been posting about how he's listening to a Beatles album a day and a Bowie album a day and introducing his son to all sorts of esoteric music.
What's the first album you've bought? Well, I'm still waiting.
Oh my God. How can I put this to someone who I admire professionally yet have only just met? There's a bit of my brain that is going off like a red alarm going, this person is not a valid human. If you'd have told me 10 years ago that I'd be married to a woman who does not really care for music, I would have laughed you out of house and home. But my wife has a similar thing to you. She will accept tunes so long as they are bouncy. So okay. She loads Radiohead, but there is still a bit of me that thinks that I am married to an automaton.
Yeah, I traded it for something else.
Well,
you traded Ben's wife in after constructing her in your lab.
That's a hell of a reveal. I've spent a lot of time with my wife kind of going, but what about this song? What about this song? In the way that other people go, kind of like, oh, what about this morsel of food? Surely you must find this delicious. Have people tested music out on you?
I've tested music out on me. It's like, noise. Wow.
And Ben is inches away from going, but you just haven't heard the right music yet.
You see, I'm now doing a lot on TikTok, and I've also, when I was at the gym, when I was allowed out, I was at the gym and I'd hear music at the gym. And I'd go, oh, this is a TikTok song, obviously. I may have things round the wrong way.
Yeah.
Could I humbly suggest, perhaps as, you know, the founder of the Guild of Makers, maybe the Anvil Chorus? Surely that's going to do it for you.
Heavy metal, definitely.
This week on the show, we are talking about the world's worst science communicator, which is Lucy's suggestion and topical, as I think we're going to discuss in these times when communication of scientific and medical realities is very important.
Lucy, we know that the one way you are not communicating is via the medium of song.
I'm gonna burst into song first of all with a look at some science communicators. And first thing I did is I looked at some of the big hitters. We've talked about him on before, friend of the show, Pliny the Elder. It'd be a shame not to mention him at some point. And the reason because we've talked about loads of we talked about him when we talked about World's Worst Doctor, various other bits and pieces. But actually, the thing about him that's interesting is that he was a science communicator of sorts. He made an effort to popularise his writings. There's a story that the Roman historian Livy ran into a friend at an a friend of a friend at an amphitheatre in Rome. And the stranger said he was visiting Rome from Spain. And he said to him, "Oh, you've doubtless heard of my writings even in Spain." And the stranger replied, "You must either be Livy or Pliny." Yeah, this anecdote sort of shows that, you know, along with Livy, Pliny was the famous writer of his time. And it's the fact that the natural history of Pliny is still with us in pretty much entirely is a testament to how popular it was, and that it was still being copied by hand before printing presses existed to propagate. And I didn't realise this about him. He was a soldier, so he wrote the book in his spare time.
Isn't that how all science writers write?
Yeah, to be fair, he wasn't on commission. He was on military commission. But he'd write by the light of his campfire while he was travelling the Empire, and he'd pick up a lot of the things that that are in it from his observations. And this is what I like. He cites from about 4,000 different works in the book.
Wow.
A lot of them are only known to us because Pliny cites them. Mm-hmm. And he says that he sort of disdains various other historians of the time who, he said, copied word for word great works from the past without actually acknowledging it in any sense or form. So in that sense, he's a pioneering science communicator, in that he had footnotes.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that some of the people that he cites, I bet we only know about because Pliny cited them.
Most of them, yeah, it seems like it, yeah. Not only that, but he said in the very first volume of The Natural History that he'd written the book to provide everyday people with information. He says it's written for the masses, for the farmers and workers, and to interest people in their leisure time. So he's writing a popular science book as much as anything else.
Brilliant.
And the thing I really like about him is we laugh at how badly wrong he gets a lot of times. Sometimes he gets it really right. For example, he writes about Eratosthenes. He cites Eratosthenes, who said that an area in Ethiopia, shadows fall in the opposite direction for 90 days every year. And basically, that's because Ethiopia is on the equator. So the midday sun is slightly one way or the other.
Yeah.
He talked about he talks about time zones, how days were different lengths in Alexandria compared to Italy, compared to Britain. How he says if you sail north of Britain, you come to an island where days lasted 6 months and then nights lasted 6 months. So, you know, he's basically talking about the Arctic Circle.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the stuff he gets right. But then I really like this section where he starts so well at this. Males are heavier than females. By and large, correct. Great. Full stop, you're fine with Pliny. Now, and the bodies of all animals are heavier when they are dead than when they are alive. They also weigh more when asleep than awake. The bodies of men float upon the back, those of women with the face downwards, as if, even after death, nature wished to spare their modesty. Oh, dear.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
How?
I think he thinks people are magnets. they have different poles. Just because we mentioned him, because, you know, a Pliny the Elder episode wouldn't be a Pliny the Elder episode without mentioning some of his medical cures. if you wanted to sort of dampen an overly active libido, a man's urine in which a lizard has been drowned is an anti-aphrodisiac poison. So also are snails and pigeons' droppings drunk with olive oil and wine, or the urine of a eunuch also has the same effect.
Sorry, but that's an anti-aphrodisiac.
Yes.
Yeah, he's right.
I mean, to be fair, yes. To be fair, he's right.
If you gave me those, I absolutely wouldn't want to fuck.
And he also said, if you have a toothache, it can be cured by using the ashes of the head of a dog that has died in a state of madness. The head, however, must be burnt without the flesh, and the ashes injected with oil of cypress into the ear of the and the side affected. If all else fails, earthworms boiled in oil and injected into the ear on the side of the affected afford considerable relief.
It's right, my ear doesn't hurt anymore. No, yes. No, yeah. No, it's fixed. It's fixed already.
I have two big questions. Question number one. You told me that Pliny was a soldier. How do we know that all of his observations and ideas weren't just PTSD taken verbal form? Secondly, the start of that cure requires a dog that has died of madness.
Rabid dog, yeah.
Oh, a rabid dog. I was going to say before that, clearly it requires a canine psychologist.
Yes. Who faces a terrible dilemma because, of course, the dog isn't allowed on the couch.
Well done.
I also read about Tycho Brahe.
He of the silver nose.
Yes, although actually apparently they dug him up a few years ago and they figured the nose is actually probably copper rather than gold or silver. Yeah, I know. Even in his own day, he was doing himself up by pretending he had a fancier nose than he actually did.
Can you explain the silver nose thing? Because I don't think I know this about him.
He had it cut off in a duel with another noble, with his cousin, in fact, a cousin called Manderup Parsberg, which is a great name. He's most famous for discovering, or certainly documenting, supernovas and comets and talking about how the heavens were movable. He rejected heliocentrism, so he didn't go the full Galileo, but which led to the two of them having a bit of like beef between them as well. But yeah, he was certainly a leading astronomer of his time, and he was given at one point 1% of the annual revenue of the Kingdom of Denmark. Wow. By the king, Frederick II, to support his observatory. Very important guy, but also kept a dwarf who he said was psychic. And also had a tame elk. His mentor, the Landgrave Wilhelm of Hesse-Kassel, asked him whether there was an animal faster than a deer, and Tycho said he could send him his tame elk to see if that was faster. And when Wilhelm replied he'd accept the elk, Tycho said, actually, sad news, the elk has just died because we went to visit a nobleman, gave the elk a little too much to drink, and it fell down the stairs.
Is his life being written by Woody Allen in the 1960s?
Have you heard of Welteislehre, cosmic ice theory?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, this was discovered, I say discovered in inverted commas, by an Austrian engineer called Hans Horbiger in 1894 during the course of a vision, because it was the 1890s. He said that he basically came to the conclusion in the course of this dream that ice is the basic substance of all cosmic processes, that the moon was made of ice, the Milky Way, ether, it was basically the building blocks of the universe. And not only that, but he used this to form what he called a new cosmic cultural history for the entirety of creation. It didn't gain much traction before World War I.
And that's because it was ice. Yeah.
But after the invention of the crampon, in 1919, yeah, he decided to, rather than go down the like respected scientific journal route, he decided to take the theory to the masses. He founded cosmo-technical societies, offered public lectures, attracted audiences of up to 1,200 people. There were cosmic ice movies, cosmic ice radio programs, journals, novels. They changed the name from a Greek sort of Latin name to a more German name, the Welteislehre, W-E-L, pushed it with like posters and pamphlets, and companies that were owned by adherents to the ideology would only hire people who convinced them, who would themselves declare that they believed in the same thing. Some of the followers attended astronomical meetings to heckle, shouting, "Out with astronomical orthodoxy, give us Horbiger." Just did the whole, we're tired of experts, this is the real truth, taking it to the people, making a popular movement to then force science to take a second look at it. really helped on by the fact that the Nazis really liked the idea as well.
Oh, no.
Yeah, afraid so. Because the reason he rebranded it with a nice Germanic name was because there was this pushback against the, you know, Jewish sciences and the Jewish theory of relativity. And after the rise of the Nazis, Hitler himself was a really enthusiastic follower of it. He said that Orbiter wasn't accepted by the scientific establishment because the fact is men do not wish to know, and the world ice theory was going to be part of a planetarium Hitler was planning to build. The ground floor was going to be Ptolemy's universe, the middle floor was going to be Copernicus, and the top floor was going to be Orbiter. All of this largely because he managed to self-publicise as well as he did, more than anything else.
Nothing's changed, has it?
No, not really. A similar era, C.W. Ledbetter, an English clergyman, Charles Webster Ledbetter, who was a follower of Theosophy, which is a religion that was founded, which basically marries Eastern mysticism and Western philosophy.
There was lots of theosophical societies that Aleister Crowley and Conan Doyle and people like that were part of.
Yeah, Annie Besant, who was a political agitator. This guy Ledbetter, he was a secretary of the London Lodge, I think. He wrote about things like clairvoyance and life after death. He was forced to step down for a couple of years because of a scandal where apparently he encouraged teenage boys to masturbate in order to turn them away from sexual temptation. And he was also involved in the raising of the Krishnamurti, an adolescent Indian boy, who he proclaimed as the most suitable candidate to be the vehicle of the world teacher, which is one of the big ideas of Theosophy, the Maitreya, the idea that there would be someone who'd come along and sort of completely realign humankind's approach to thinking and evolution. And they raised this kid, basically gave him the best education, brought him around the world, you know, showed him off at all these sort of meetings. In the mid-1920s, Krishnamurti moved away from it, and by 1929 he actually dissolved the organisation that had been created by the Theosophical Society to promote his own coming. And he went on and, you know, he sort of went solo, if you like. He left the Beatles and went and...
That was a musical reference, wasn't it? Wasted on me.
But the reason I really like Ledbetter is because he published a book titled The Hidden Side of Things, in which he created a whole new branch of the evolutionary tree.
The Hidden Side of Things? That sounds like The Secret Life of Cats.
Not cats, fairies.
Of course.
He elaborated on his theory of, he called it evolvement, showing how there were different fairy evolutionary lines in nature. He says, the life which is now animating fairies has come up through grasses and cereals when it was in the vegetable kingdom, and afterwards through ants and bees when it was in the animal kingdom. Now it has reached the level of these tiny nature spirits. So basically, once insects have evolved into fairies, then he observed them and he laid out the family trees and the evolutionary lines of the different genera of fairies, like Darwin or Linnaeus did with the natural world. And he said they had different colours of their own, marking the difference between their tribe or species, just as the birds have difference of plumage. And his work was cited by Arthur Conan Doyle when he was writing in the Strand magazine about the Cottingley fairies and the pictures of the little girls with the cutout of the fairies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's pretty bad in terms of, he was going to be my choice in terms of how far his theory managed to reach, that he sort of nudged his way as an Anglican priest who turned away from it to talk about fairies. Maybe not such a weird idea, actually. Then I read about Dr. Henry Cotton. This guy is not fun.
Yeah.
I apologise in advance. Between 1907 and 1930, he was the medical director of the New Jersey State Hospital in Trenton. And his theories of mental illness, influenced by a guy called Adolf Meyer, he... believed that mental illness...
I have to say, as a little Jewish man, Adolf Meyer is a very conflicting name.
Yes, he would have been. He would have offered a different opinion to Jung and Freud, if you like. They were. He was offering ideas that mental illness was connected to physical ailments, and so Cotton's solution was that if there was a physical infection, then we would need to remove the infection, and he strongly believed that most of these infections were in the teeth. So, under his direction, he extracted 11,000 teeth from mentally ill patients in his hospital. When they didn't improve, because he was pulling out their teeth, he then said the infection must have spread elsewhere to other organs, which he then on 645 different occasions also removed. Testicles, ovaries, gallbladders, stomachs, spleens, cervixes, colons particularly. He was particularly fixated on the idea that there'd be fecal matter build-up in colons. And he claimed that he had an 80 to 85% success rate and publicised that so widely that this fabricated figure led to him becoming very popular and to people going to their doctors because they couldn't see him and demanding that they give them the same treatment.
In the 20s?
The 10s, 20s and into the 30s, yeah.
Sorry, was that 2020s?
No, he never advised anyone to drink bleach, in fairness to him. But he was so good, again, at publicising himself that he got loads of attention. He got medical institutions and associations were honouring him in the USA, the UK, around Europe. He was giving speeches and sharing papers about it. The New York Times wrote a review of him in 1922, reviewing his published lectures. They said, at the State Hospital in Trenton, New Jersey, under the brilliant leadership of the medical director, Dr. Henry A. Cotton, there is on foot the most searching, aggressive and profound scientific investigation that there has yet been made of the whole field of mental and nervous disorders. There is hope, high hope, for the future.
This is completely the opposite of the chap's name, Semmelweis, who he was a doctor and said, hey everyone, you know when the midwives work with the mothers and babies, they only have a certain percent death rate, and when we work with them we have a much higher death rate. I think it's because we go straight from autopsy to helping the mothers without washing our hands. And all the other doctors said, no, don't be ridiculous, you're wrong. He said, no, I've done this experiment and I've shown that it's true. But they didn't like him. He wasn't very good self-publicist. And they put him in a mental institution.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he'd had Bell Pottinger working to, you know, as his PR support, it might have saved more lives more quickly.
I read a thing, wasn't it, that's, I mean, obviously good on Semmelweis for putting that forward, but I read an article that said, let's be real here, most of the people who were working beneath him would have been women who were nurses, and they would did a lot of the practical muck and nettles work, and it's probably them that came up with the idea. And he being, you know, the bloke in charge, because at that time all blokes were in charge, he took the credit that was then swiftly battered away from him.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, it's funny you should mention female nurses, and because Cotton was getting sort of a bit of flack early on in his career for sort of mistreating and being a bit too heavy-handed with his patients, and so he replaced all of his male nurses with female ones to escape condemnation. The New York Times again wrote, the men are naturally too rough with patients and that male patients are not so excited by the approach of women nurses. Cotton believes that the presence of women nurses is restful to the diseased mind. In fairness to him, at least he believed his own work, because he did pull his own teeth out when he thought he was going mad during an investigation by the New Jersey State Senate and pulled out the teeth of his wife and children.
Yes, because that is what a sane person would do.
I have a theory it was probably a convenient madness at the time of the trial, rather like Rupert Murdoch's convenient early onset dementia when Eve Wayne came before the Commons Committee's investigating phone tapping in the UK and all of those sort of things. He also, there was investigations into his work by Dr. Phyllis Greenacre, a woman who was one of the students of this same guy, Dr. Adolf Meyer, and she found all sorts of horrendous things. She singled out 62 patients who'd been victims of his surgeries. 17 of them had died right away. Several others had died a few months later. Only 5% of the patients recovered completely. 3 improved but were still symptomatic, and the remaining patients unimproved. But her report was suppressed because Mayer kind of believed Cotton more than he believed this woman, Phyllis Greenacre. And so, you know, had her reassigned, didn't let the report get published. And so Cotton survived that. He survived the New Jersey State Senate investigation. There was another investigation which didn't get published, which again showed what terrible work this was doing. And what he himself admitted to death rates as high as 30% in his published papers. It may have been as high as 45% at times. And when he died of a heart attack in 1933, he was lauded again. The New York Times seemed to love him. The local press, international professional publications called him a pioneer. He didn't get the public re-evaluation he needed in his own lifetime, sadly. And so I'm going to put forward Dr., in inverted commas, Henry Cotton. Presumably the cotton to stuff in your mouth after you've had the teeth extracted.
Well, he is a world-class early 20th century medical fraudster, self-promoter and shitbag. Lucy, what...
Thank you.
Sorry, that was a really Partridge-esque link. I do apologise. What have you brought for us?
I'm getting really frustrated with the political and medical science communication that's going on at the moment. So I've taken a step back and gone for, let's call it miscommunication, bad communications. So I'm bringing back to 2014. The French train operator SNCF bought 2,000 new trains. They cost 15 billion euros. And they got them, they put them in, and then they realised that they wouldn't fit in over 1,000 of the platforms in France.
Oh my God.
The trains were too fat.
They couldn't fit wideways as opposed to lengthways.
Wideways.
Oh,
wideways.
Wow.
They'd smashed into the platform as they came into the station.
Forget the fat controller, they had fat Thomas the Tank Engines.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And that is, of course, where Kevin Eldon got the idea for his show, Big Train.
Did they return them? Did they rebuild the platforms?
50 million euros it cost to fix all the platforms, and they had to just change the platforms because there were too many trains.
Oh my God.
Now, the reason for this is because the train operator and the rail operator, so that the people who owned the tracks and the people who owned the trains were different. And the rail operator was RFF. And so the train operator said, how big are your platforms? And so RFF said, oh, well, the ones we've built in the last 30 years are so wide. But they didn't mention that the ones built over 30 years ago were wider. We discovered this problem a little late.
I feel like inbuilt obsolescence isn't really useful when it comes to public infrastructure.
Because, yeah, all the trains were slimmer 50 years ago.
That's of course they were. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that is amazing. Oh, my God. But that's not the only sort of vehicle-based one that you mentioned. You mentioned there was one about Airbus, you said to us, wasn't there?
There's Airbus and there's also NASA.
Oh, go on. Absolutely. Lay them all on us.
Yeah. Okay. Airbus. It's the Airbus A380, built 2007. Part of it was built by one country and another part by another country. Bought the two bits together, so it was the fuselage and the nose cone bit. And then they came to connect all the wires. And they discovered that the wires were about 5 centimetres too short to connect. So they connect the fuselage to the nose cone, and they still can't connect over 300 miles of cables in this thing.
Oh, my God. Are all Airbuses held together by those four plug extender cables that we all have? Yeah.
The thing is, they couldn't just do that because that actually puts extra resistance in. And when you're going a whole load of, you know, all that distance in on the cables. So they've had to rewire an awful lot of it. And they say it's not, it wasn't just communication. It was because after some of the tests, they had to reroute some of the cables. But that was just it wouldn't have taken much to make everything a bit, just that little bit longer.
Now, you've just reminded me, this is a slight digression, is it making airplanes or something else where they use ferrets to deliver wires down really long pipes?
What?
This is a half-remembered, this is one of those classic Worsford Ford half-remembered articles I've read once, where they use ferrets to go down long, to basically, you know, with a wire tied around his tail, to clamber down a long pipe to get it from one end to the other.
My dad used the cat once to do that.
You what?
My dad once used the cat to do that. Can't really remember because I was very small, but he got the floorboards up and put a collar on the cat and a piece of string. And then the cat went under the floorboards to the other hole at the other end, undid the string, and then he could feed the wire through.
Oh, I knew I was right. You do live in a Wallace and Gromit house.
I'm not making this up. Okay, now listen. When the US Space Command was working on its New Year 2000 Missile Warning Center at Patterson Air Force Base in Colorado, Misty the Ferret was able to carry new wires down 40-foot-long conduits with ease in exchange for a strawberry Pop-Tart, apparently.
I'd do it for a strawberry Pop-Tart, to be fair.
They were They were used to lay TV, lighting and sound cables for the Millennium Concert in Britain. Three ferrets named Beckham, Posh and Baby.
Oh my God.
And apparently they're used for laying other cables in other industries as well. So
do you think that they did this properly scientifically, that they also tried it with weasels and with pine martens, but it was ferrets who had the true engineering ability?
Yeah, I think ferrets were of a slightly higher class. Maybe that's what had happened with this Airbus thing, that they used ferrets, and the ferrets, in a fit of pique, nibbled 5 centimetres off every single wire.
Do you think
they just said, I want to go over that and under this and round that, and I'll just double back now.
Yes.
They took the scenic route.
Never pick an animal that enjoys gamboling when you're doing intricate engineering. Do you think that the people who put together the Airbus had a whole toolbox full of the animals of farthing wood for different problems? Like, you know, if they needed to do, I don't know,
woodpecker drilling?
Stick it. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. You know, a badger for all the roll plugs. I don't know. A fox for some of the really deft bits.
The moles for digging.
Very good.
Yes.
Yeah. And what was the NASA one?
Mars Climate Orbiter. This was back in 1998. It was launched, and this was going to go to Mars. A spacecraft going to go to Mars. It was going to orbit Mars, and bring back all great scientific information. So it got there, everything was going fine, and then it crashed into Mars. And it was meant to go, you know, into orbit, go round and round.
Right.
And the reason for this was because one of the suppliers giving the information was working in Imperial, in miles.
No.
And the other was working in kilometres.
Oh, God. It's the Spinal Tap incident at NASA.
This is why UKIP is and their campaigns to keep the pound and the imperial measurements and get us out of Europe. This is the sort of damage they're going to cause.
Like UKIP are interested in colonising another planet. That's the last thing they want.
This cost $327.6 million. It was for both the orbiter and the lander. So there were two spacecraft that went out. So it was actually the crasher and the lander. $193 million for spacecraft development.
But can you imagine the people who are working on that? Like, sitting there in mission control. Because you always get those days of when, like, you get the successful launch where everyone stands and claps, and you get the successful landing where everyone stands and claps. And everyone's there waiting for it to, you know, confirm that it's in orbit and that we're here and we've made it all the way. However, it takes, 6 to 8 months to get to Mars, plus all of the years of research and time.
Yeah.
And they're just watching it go, do you think it should have stopped now? They're still getting closer and closer and closer. I was shouting, break at the TV screen.
You can see everyone just, no, squeezing everything shut. No, stop.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't. Yeah. Oh, God. That's
just. I just wonder how that can, in a mission that long and big and expensive, how was that not missed?
They have done a huge report on it, being NASA, and I don't think it'll ever happen again.
Like NASA don't have a scorpion, or didn't have a scorpion pit up until that moment. But whoever made that mistake has been thrown into it. And if you're going to work for NASA, then as a mathematician, you're brought along and shown the person in the scorpion pit and going, get your sums right, mate.
To be fair to NASA, they have a long and noble history of learning the hard way.
This is true.
But of all of those, the French drains being too wide for the platform is your choice for the world's worst science communication.
Definitely.
I love how your choice was planes, trains and space shuttles. Yeah. speaking from my personal experience, I would say my year 10 physics teacher, Mr. Cam, who had the nickname Lurch, who was both 6'7" and possessed all of the charisma of a brick. But I don't want to make things too personal. I looked at something that I think we've mentioned before, which is academics who have submitted deliberately bullshit papers in order to either settle scores or to see whether the periodicals will notice them.
I remember them well.
So in December 2013, a software professional submitted a bogus paper entitled Use of Cloud Computing and Social Media to Determine Box Office Performance, which was accepted by, I think it must be an Indian-based research forum, because it's in somewhere called Bhubaneswar, which looks like an Indian name to me. The paper's introductory section itself cautioned that it contained some gibberish that was auto-generated by software. One section of the paper also included 19 lines about the 1970s Bollywood film Sholay and another 19 lines from the Hollywood film My Cousin Vinny, starring Joe Pesci. The incident highlighted a practice where poor quality papers are accepted from students who are then asked to pay a few thousand rupees to participate in the conferences. And it's basically this really awful practice called predatory journals, where it's sort of like pay to play for academics. And it was trying to reveal that. There's another one, that this is one of my favourites. In 2014, an Australian computer scientist called Dr. Peter Vamplew submitted a paper to the International Journal of Advanced Computer Technology. He did this because he was angered that the journal would not take him off its own mailing list. The article was entitled Get Me Off Your Fucking Mailing List. And it consisted of the phrase Get Me Off Your Fucking Mailing List repeated throughout the entirety of the body of the article.
Was it peer-reviewed?
Hear me out. It even included a graph where he had plotted points so that the graph read, Get me off your fucking mailing list. The journal requested to the researcher that he should add some more recent references and a bit of reformatting, saying that the article suitability for the journal was otherwise excellent. Yeah, another great one. This feels like a Facebook meme that got out of hand. Christoph Bartnek, who's an associate professor in information technology at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. He was invited to submit a paper to the International Conference on Atomic and Nuclear Physics in 2016. He wondered why he'd been asked to do this, since he had little knowledge of nuclear physics. So
please tell me he went like that guy who was interviewed on BBC News that time.
Taxi driver.
The taxi driver who was interviewed about, was it copyright in online piracy?
He went one better. He used his Apple iPhone's autocomplete function to write a paper, choosing random suggestions after starting each sentence, and submitted it under the name Iris Pear as a reference to Siri and Apple. Here's a sample sentence for you from the abstract. The atoms of a better universe will have the right for the same as you are, the way we shall have to be a great place for a great time, to enjoy the day you are a wonderful person to your great time, to take the fun and take a great time and enjoy the great day you will be a wonderful time for your parents and kids. Sounds like a
speech writer.
Precisely. To be honest, Lucy, you're not far wrong, because the 516-word abstract contained the words good and great over a combined total of 28 times, which is bang on the money for Trump, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he's made him presidential advisor on sciences now.
Oh, God. Despite making no sense, the work was accepted within 3 hours of submission, and a conference registration fee of $1,099 was requested. So the spirit of Trump is in there as well.
Hang on. They requested the fee to appear then. That's a nice move by the conference, going, all right, we'll call your bluff.
Two more of these.
Sadly, that's a common thing.
Oh, really?
It's like the paper vanity papers. There's vanity conference.
Right. Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, listen, me and Barry work in a world where there is much vanity publishing, podcasting and performing. It's called all of it.
Yeah, I'm just stinging from a recent rejection of a script, the process of which involves them reading the first 10 pages of the script and then saying yes or no. And to think that that guy's paper got accepted after
Actually,
3 hours.
Submit it to the science journals.
That's what I should be doing if I'm prepared to fork out $199. I could be a professor emeritus.
Yeah, you can be a playwright emeritus. I think you'll enjoy this story a lot more. This features Dr. Elaine Murphy, and she hoaxed the British Medical Journal in 1974 by filing a report on the fictional medical condition known as cellulescrotum. Because you'll have heard of tennis elbow.
Yeah.
You may have heard of jogger's nipple. But in a letter co-signed with her husband, John, who had submitted a previous letter regarding the condition of guitar nipple.
Where are they holding their instruments?
Yeah, well, she suggested that because of the way that male players girdled their cello, they suffered from the complaint of cello scrotum. And it wasn't until 2009 that she admitted that it was a hoax in another letter to the BMJ. There is a similar one from May 2017 from Peter Boghossian and James Lindsay, who published a paper on the Cogent Social Sciences Journal that argued that the penis is best understood not as a biological organ, but rather as a social construct. but they decided to then top that notion by saying that the conceptual penis is in fact a driver behind much of climate change. And
being in lockdown, so many of us are having to make do with conceptual penis.
Yeah. I think your husband would like to have words with you.
Please, Ben, my meta husband.
What you've just said there is funnier than anything they put in their paper. So I'm going to tell you about my nomination for the world's worst scientific communicator. It's Alexander Graham Bell. He may have invented the telephone, something that he doesn't consider all that important, but in one other area, he was an impressively accomplished man, but also a horrifying and selfish shitbag. Let me tell you a bit about his background. It's no accident that he invented the phone. His father, grandfather, and brother were all highly interested in the world of elocution and acoustics, because Alexander Graham Bell's mother was profoundly deaf.
Yeah, I think I knew that. I think it was his sister as well.
No, his wife was also deaf.
His wife, yes, yeah.
Yes, his wife, who he met when doing workshop tours of various deaf schools. And his relationship with his wife is one that I'm going to say borderline creepy. He met her, you know, working on her as a patient when I think she was quite a bit younger than him. So that we'll put that as a minor black mark in amongst what I'm about to tell you about. He was remarkably talented. He was interested in art and poetry and music, which was encouraged by his mother. And he became the family pianist at the time. And even despite being quiet and introspective, he reveled in mimicry and ventriloquism. And that's very much a communication black mark as far as I'm concerned. Understandably,
I'm just trying to work out how ventriloquism works with a deaf audience.
Better.
I want to see ventriloquism with a deaf audience and a mute ventriloquist.
Yes.
And a blind dummy.
Understandably, he became obsessed with being able to communicate with his mother. He learned essentially a form of, I guess, a Morse code that he created for his mother, where he would tap on his mother's lap what was being spoken in the parlour so she could understand. He also developed a technique of speaking in clear, modulated tones directly into his mother's forehead, where she could hear him via the vibrations and understand what was being said, which I guess is a very, very moving way of being able to communicate to his mother, but also really creepy.
It's like someone has taught him how to kiss, but wrong.
Yeah!
This is the way we kiss in my culture.
Yeah. But his father, Alexander Melville Bell, he developed a form of communication called visible speech. This was like a forerunner and, I guess, competitor of sign language. And it was a method of using symbols to teach people to speak a language that they'd never heard. Phonetic symbols that represent the position of the speech organs in articulating sounds. The system is composed of symbols that show the movement of the throat, the tongue, and the lips. He also created it written in two short forms using a system of 29 modifiers and tones, 52 consonants, 36 vowels, and a dozen diphthongs, and they were named World English. And it was sort of similar to the International Phonetic Alphabet and also line writing used by stenographers. Alexander Graham Bell became incredibly proficient at it, and he was even able to decipher visible speech representing a myriad of languages, including Latin, Scots, Gaelic, and even Sanskrit. So it was incredible, and it worked. It was just extremely difficult and time-consuming. And when sign language was invented in the sort of 1870s, Bell found it very threatening to the thing that him and his father had developed. And he also considered it a lesser form of communication and also hated it because he thought it stopped deaf people integrating into wider society and would lead to deaf people forming their own culture. And there is a big thing in I guess, deaf culture. Deaf people don't consider themselves disabled, or a lot of them don't in the way that other people do. They just consider themselves a different subculture. So I guess in a way, Alexander Graham Bell will have agreed with this, but he actively campaigned against the use of sign language.
I mean, that's nonsense, as you're evidently putting forward. But he's saying they won't integrate into our culture because if they're not learning our language, we might have to learn their language.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this alphabet his dad made up. How do we know he was any good at it? If no one else was using it, he could just have told us.
Obviously, the two Alexander Bells were the most proficient proponents and exponents. But other people used this form. It was also known as oralism, which, insert your own joke here.
Conceptual penises.
Yeah. Are the conceptual penises your vocal harmony group that you and your husband are forming?
Yeah, you're back on music, aren't you?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. So Alexander Graham Bell gets worse. There was in 1880 in Milan, there was the Second International Congress on Education of the Deaf, which bizarrely, despite its name, was the first international conference of deaf educators. There were 164 representatives present. How many of them, Lucy and Barry, do you think were deaf?
I'm going to say one, and it's his wife.
No, less than that.
Yeah, I have to tell you that Barry is correct. It is one.
Was it his wife?
It wasn't his wife. She wasn't allowed to attend. She was a woman. Yeah. It was the 1880s. What are you thinking, Barry?
Of course.
And it gets worse for Alexander Graham Bell. In 1884, he wrote, "Upon the formation of a deaf variety of the human race." And not only did he condemn sign language as a foreign language, he also suggested that it should be banned, that deaf teachers should be outlawed, that visible speech should be used to assimilate deaf children into main education, that deaf people shouldn't be allowed to marry each other, and I'm sure you can hear a tinkling in the background of where this is going, that deaf people should be sterilised. Because Alexander Graham Bell, in the early 20th century, he helped form the first international congress of eugenics.
Of course he did. And
he was just upset that they couldn't use his phone, weren't they?
Yeah, he really knows how to hold a grudge.
He was just trying to grow his own market.
It's quite a parade of villains who are part of this first international congress. A who's who of gentleman with checkered records. Its first president was Leonard Darwin, the son of Charles Darwin, yes. who was agreed amongst the Darwin family to be the stupidest of Darwin's sons. Alexander Graham Bell, of course, and also the first Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill.
He just cropped. He got a lot of places.
Yeah, he, you know, that's why he wanted to take down the Nazis, because they were cutting in on his action.
Yes.
History
will be written by the winners, but the winners will definitely be blonde-haired and blue-eyed, if I have my way about it. Whichever side wins.
And also hammered out of their minds on brandy.
Yeah.
Our suggestions this week for the World's Scientific Communicator are the Mental Health Tooth Fairy, suggested by Barry, Dr. Henry Cotton, Lucy's suggestion of the overweight French trains as designed by SNCF, or mine, the father of telecommunication himself, Alexander Graham Bell. Oh, it's a tough one. It's a real tough one. I mean, so Lucy, you chose sort of a lack of communication amongst scientists, which is, it's very tempting. And I, they're all very good. And just the image of this wide-assed French train pulling into and against platforms is very tempting. Barry,
it's curb crawling.
Yeah.
Barry's is very tempting because he's just such an awful man. And he's a self-promoter as well. But I'm very tempted by Alexander Graham Bell.
Because he's a science communicator in so many ways.
Yeah, he was. And listen, both Henry Cotton and the engineers at SNCF would not have been able to communicate their mistakes so so broadly if it wasn't for Alexander Graham Bell
inventing
the telephone.
Unless
they were deaf.
Not to mention with the help of the ferrets.
Yeah.
Laying all those wires in the first place. It's the ferrets that we really have to pin the blame on, Ben.
Yeah, we absolutely should.
Essentially what I'm doing is I'm making sure that digression about ferrets is staying in the podcast.
Oh, it absolutely has to. And obviously, one thing we didn't talk about is how, I don't know if you know this, but undersea cables are actually laid by water ferrets. Which can grow up to 4 or 5 metres in length.
Mer ferrets,
yeah, exactly. I mean, we may not necessarily agree on who the world's worst scientific communicator is, but we have created a new type of fauna.
Yeah. Or porn, depending on what way you look.
Oh, God. So, yeah, I'm going to self-nominate. I'm going to go with old AGB, a man who did not care for his invention or indeed for the welfare of deaf people. Before we go, I'm going to give you the world's best news of the week, because we're giving you good news until this lockdown is over. And this is lovely. A dog at the Last Chance Animal Rescue in Edenbridge called Bess is a dog who has been named Britain's loneliest because they have been living at this animal rescue for 10 years because no one would take her. But after 10 years, someone has finally taken Bess.
Don't say the Grim Reaper, Ben, because that's not going to be...
According to a spokesman at the Animal Rescue Centre, it was very emotional for everyone as she set off to a new life, but also very rewarding, as a loving home is what we want for all our dogs. And finally, we have one for our Bess. And ferrets, yeah, as well. And I sort of don't know why it's taken so long, because looking at it, she's just a perfectly nice sheep dog, black and white, maybe a little overweight, but, you know, I don't know, body shame a dog.
Do we know anything about the family who adopted her? They could be horrible people, Ben. Maybe it's not good news.
Well, join us next week to find out. Yeah, gosh, I mean, it might be people who've gone, hey, listen, we're on lockdown, we need all the meat we can get. Yeah, they've literally bought themselves a pedigree chum. Before we go, Lucy, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
I am on Twitter and TikTok as at Dr. Lucy Rogers, where I am not singing, you'll be pleased to know. various bits of putting science into plain English, having fun and showing videos of my dog. I've also got a website, www.lucyrogers.com, where a lot of my mad inventions are.
Outstanding. Well, we're all off to train some ferrets to see if they can get some string, attach it to a baked bean tin, and run the 8 miles to between mine and Barry's house. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.